Hello, and welcome to this week's Serve Digest podcast. I'm William Law, editor of the Digest. You know, Arab Digest is something of a rarity in Middle East analysis. Our daily newsletter has no sponsors, and we carry our podcasts without any advertising. It's our subscribers who support Arab Digest, and we intend to keep it that way. To find out how you can support a truly independent voice in the Middle East and North Africa, head to ArabDigest.org. When you go to the website, check out how you can receive our reader-supported daily newsletter for 2 months for free. My guest today is Dania Ahad. Dania is the senior investigative editor at Middle East Eye and a regular contributor to the Arab Digest podcast. Our conversation today will focus on the issue of humanitarian aid to Gaza. Israel says it's not to blame for the catastrophe unfolding in Gaza. We'll explore the veracity of that claim. Dania, good to have you back.
Bill, thanks for having me.
You've been investigating the humanitarian aid picture in Gaza for Middle East Eye, and as with every other aspect of this war, it's very grim. Looking at the number of aid workers already killed, the facilities that have been destroyed, can you just give our listeners an overview of the humanitarian aid situation?
Of course. And Bill, thanks for having me on and for giving me some time to shed light on this topic with you, which is on, it's gotten a little bit lost since the Israel-Iran head-to-head. So I'm glad we can look at it. The picture for aid workers in Gaza is really a shocking one. And it's not just shocking for outsiders like me who are reporting on this, but for the aid workers on the ground in Gaza themselves. They're telling me, these are experienced aid workers. This isn't their first, you know, emergency conflict rodeo. They've been around the block. And they're telling me that the incidence of attacks on their sites and their convoys and the killing of their colleagues is just unprecedented. It's something that they've just not ever seen in another conflict that they've worked on. You know, so just to get into the specifics, up until yesterday, so that would have been the 21st of April, the aid worker security database, which is really great, by the way, reported that 227 aid workers have been killed in Gaza since the 7th of October.
Let me just stop you there, because that is an extraordinary number. Just say that again, Dania.
227 aid workers have been killed in Gaza since the 7th of October.
My goodness. With other conflicts, I mean, how does that compare?
I saw an article that did a comparison on this, and I think my understanding is that that's more than have been killed, were killed in Syria. Also, it's a lot more than have been killed previously in Gaza. And obviously, the most recent wars in Gaza, 2014, 2009, 2008, were a lot shorter than this six-month ongoing conflict that we see now. But I mean, the deaths of aid workers in those previous wars were, you know, I could count them on my hands. So 227 is quite a bit by comparison.
Yeah, I think the number of aid workers killed in Syria, and that's over more than 10 years of civil war, is approximately 120. And then you look at the destruction of buildings, the infrastructure of these humanitarian aid organizations, and it's truly awful.
Yeah, entirely. There's the buildings that we think about, you know, that come to mind immediately, like the hospitals that have been hit. You know, I think the latest figure is something like 10 out of 36 of those hospitals are still functioning, but, you know, the others have been destroyed and damaged. And there's schools that have been damaged. And you know, a lot of these structures weren't just functioning as hospitals and schools. They were structures that were hosting tens of thousands of displaced people. I think I read somewhere at least 428 displaced people alone have been killed at UNRWA shelters since the 7th of October. In shelters, 428 people killed. So, I mean, if you aren't safe at a shelter, what does that say? But there's also, you know, there's also bits of infrastructure that maybe we don't think about that have been destroyed that make aid work so much more difficult. And I'm thinking of things here like roads and trucks, but there's also things like, you know, water and sanitation and hygiene facilities. So, you know, toilets, for example. And that means, you know, without those kind of facilities, there's a lack of safe and clean water. And that poses a real threat for waterborne diseases. And think about it, the summer's coming. So, there's apparently 270,000 tons of solid waste just sitting around Gaza right now. So, it's not just, empty buildings being hit or facilities where people have left, to find shelter. These are critical infrastructure that's creating an even worse situation for aid workers who don't feel safe and who don't seem to be particularly safe trying to distribute this aid in a completely broken landscape.
Yeah, that's a really important point you make too about the sewage facilities being destroyed, sewage treatment plants being destroyed, and of course water treatment as well being knocked out. Now on Monday, Dania, the UN released a report by the former French Foreign Minister Catherine Colonna, which noted that the Israelis had provided no evidence to back up their claim that UNRWA workers were involved in the 7th of October Hamas attack. Now, that allegation had led to many Western nations suspending financial support to UNRWA. Some have since come back on board, but major funders, the US and the UK, are still suspending funding. And one has to ask why, because, where is the evidence to back up that claim?
And that's a good question. And I think, one could ask, did she find evidence to back up that claim? And no, as far as I've seen from the review that she put out, I read through it, and the press conference she gave, she did not find any evidence to back up that claim. However, it should be said, and she made this clear in the press conference she gave, which was actually a really interesting watch if anybody has time, that it wasn't really the mandate of her investigation to look into those claims specifically. Her mandate was to look at kind of the bureaucracy, the policies and procedures at UNRWA. So there's this other investigation going on, and that's led by the UN Office of Internal Oversight Services, which, as I understand it, is basically like the UN's investigative agency. So they're looking specifically at those allegations. But I think it's also fair to say the reason why so many of the stories reporting on the report focused on that one little section of the report that said that Israel hadn't offered any evidence of its allegations. I think a lot of journalists hooked onto that line because Israel hasn't made its evidence public yet. And, as you said, a lot of governments have now reestablished their support for UNRWA. Australia did so, saying, there was the lack of evidence. Its intelligence services couldn't find evidence for what Israel was saying. So until the evidence is out in public, I think people are going to wonder. And I know, the UK, for example, has said it's going to wait to read through the Colonna report. We still don't know what the UK is going to do and if it's going to be satisfied. But yeah, until that evidence comes out in public, there's still going to be questions.
Yeah, and of course, that continues to have huge impacts on the humanitarian situation in Gaza.
Yeah, definitely, because UNRWA is the largest agency on the ground there. It has the most distributive power. So it's a huge problem, and it's also a problem for the other areas where UNRWA works. It's not just Gaza, it's Syria, it's Lebanon, the West Bank. There's huge ramifications for funding being cut from UNRWA. So yeah, it's a big issue.
The killing of seven aid workers, that's going back a couple of weeks now, from World Central Kitchen sparked huge condemnation globally and did force the IDF to take some action. Was that simply because the victims, aside from their driver, were all foreign nationals and not Palestinians? Because as I understand it, Danya, most of those people, aid workers that have been killed, are Palestinians.
Yeah. Most of the aid workers killed have been Palestinians, and many of them have been killed in their homes alongside their families. So the attention on the World Central Kitchen attack, I think, at first blush, I think you could say, yeah, it got a lot of attention because foreign nationals were involved. And I think a lot of people feel pretty strongly that's why it made headlines. But, before the World Central Kitchen attack, you had at least 357 hits on deconflicted humanitarian sites and convoys in Gaza. So that was, 357 World Central Kitchen attacks before the actual World Central Kitchen attack. Of course, not all of those attacks were as lethal or, as egregious. We'll get into the details of the attack. But those were all attacks that had happened before that one.
You mentioned this term deconfliction. What is deconfliction?
I'm using deconfliction as a shorthand for what humanitarians call humanitarian notification systems. And that's purely just basically organizations sharing their coordinates with parties to a conflict so that they know where they're located. So it could be a building or it could be a convoy on the move, but it's sharing their coordinates so that the parties to the conflict have an understanding of where they are and don't attack them.
Got it. Okay. Thank you for that.
But it's only with this one attack that we suddenly start seeing, you know, concerns about deconfliction and humanitarians in Gaza hit the mainstream, you know, really start getting raised publicly. But, you know, of course, aid workers had themselves been raising these concerns for months and months, but it's only after this one attack that you get so much attention on it. You know, and I think definitely one of the reasons is because of the different countries that the aid workers came from, including, you know, the US and the UK, two major allies of Israel. And, you know, so both the leaders, you know, Biden and Sunak were forced to make statements and take positions and put pressure on Israel, generating even more headlines. But, you know, I think there's a couple other reasons why this attack got so much attention. I think one of the reasons is kind of the way it happened. And it's just pretty egregious when you look at it. It was sort of in a matter of 4 minutes, you have three cars and a convoy. And this convoy had been cleared ahead of time with the Israeli military. You have these cars hit with missiles one by one by one. So as one car is hit, the aid workers move to the next car. And then as that car is hit, the aid workers move to the next car. And according to reports I've seen, basically the missiles just keep hitting until everybody stops moving. So, you know, it's pretty egregious. And in the wake of the attack, you had the World Central Kitchen's founder saying that they believed they'd been deliberately targeted. And I think, you know, given the details, you can sympathize with his take on that. You know, it's three cars hit one by one. And I think that can feel quite intentional. But, you know, 72 hours later, which is a record, and we can talk more about that. But you get the Israeli military's explanation of what happened. So according to the Israeli military, yes, the World Central Kitchen had communicated their plans to COGAT. COGAT's the Israeli agency that oversees the Palestinian territories, including Gaza. COGAT had sent those details to the Israeli military's Southern Command, which would have been in charge of the drones that were overhead over the convoy. But somewhere along the lines, the Israeli military says that the details weren't passed along. So the drone operators misread what was happening on the ground. And, you know, with the sign off from their superiors, they went ahead and fired at this convoy. So you get more detail there that explains sort of the picture that we were seeing, you know, that Jose Andre would have been commenting on, and it fills in some of the gaps, but quite an egregious attack, having, you know, knowing that the World Central Kitchen staff had deconflicted their plan and their convoy. But I also think that one of the other reasons that this attack created so much public pressure to fix the system was that the World Central Kitchen, which is an American NGO, had very good relations with Israel. So Israel had allowed the World Central Kitchen to build this temporary jetty to get aid in from Cyprus. And I heard from Jamie McGoldrick, who was the most recent top UN aid official in Gaza. He was telling me that World Central Kitchen got better treatment than the UN from the Israelis. So the, you know, World Central Kitchen had a really good relationship with the Israelis. So I think for those in the know, this attack was particularly significant because this was an organization you would have expected to be safe that clearly wasn't. Yeah. And so for people who already knew that the system was broken, this was kind of a straw on the camel's back, I think.
Yeah. And an organization based in Washington and the founder with a close friendly relationship with indeed the president of the United States, as you say, egregious. And you also make the point in the article you did for Middle East Eye that aid workers are not supposed to be operating inside a battlefield. And you quote one as saying, it's a nightmarish hell scenario. The Israeli position is that the IDF does not deliberately target aid workers or their infrastructure. You've already indicated some skepticism, rightfully so, I think, about that claim. But overall, what do you make of that position that the IDF takes?
Well, you know, some of the leaders of these organizations themselves have said that they believe their staff and infrastructure have been targeted. So like I just mentioned, you've got Jose Andre, the founder of World Central Kitchen, coming out right after this attack, saying he had believed they were deliberately targeted and that he believed Israel was waging a war on humanity itself, on humanitarians. And then, you know, last week we had UNRWA's Commissioner General Philippe Lazzarini telling the UN Security Council that he believes the agency's premises and staff have been targeted since the beginning of the war. You know, aid workers that I spoke to for this story were a bit more circumspect. And I really did. I asked them straight up, do you think you guys are being targeted? And they would sort of, they said, you know, it's a question that they think about within their organizations. They wonder if they're being deliberately targeted, but it's not like a cut and dry, there are no cut and dry answers for them. It's an open question that kind of looms over them. And I think, you know, it's a really hard thing to prove the intention of some of these attacks without having, you know, insider knowledge about how these decisions are being made and how information is being passed or not passed up and down the chain of command within the Israeli military. But I think it's also really important to point out that aid organizations say it's really hard to get information after these attacks happen, after these hits happen. So, you know, like I said before, the World Central Kitchen attack, we had answers within 72 hours, but that's definitely not the norm. You know, you can look, for example, there was a hit on a compound, a medical aid for Palestine and International Rescue Committee compound back in January. These two organizations said that they've had six different explanations from the Israeli officials about why that happened and what happened. I also talked to the head of the emergency unit for Doctors Without Borders, and they told me that every time they have a hit on one of their facilities or one of their staff, they send an official letter to COGAT and they ask for feedback and investigation. And they have never received a written answer explaining why or what happened in any of these situations. And he said sometimes they get like an oral answer, but there's nothing formal and there's apparently nothing in depth that they get to explain it. And I think this kind of lack of clarity or answers from the Israeli side fuels a sense that the military doesn't respect humanitarians. And that's kind of a theme that came up time and again when I was talking to people for this story. There's just a sense in the humanitarian community that their work is not understood or respected. One of the aid workers I spoke to was saying that, you know, it seems like to him, all Palestinians in Gaza are now perceived as an enemy by the Israeli military. And humanitarians, of course, are helping those Palestinians. And so he said, by default, he feels that by helping them, they've also become an enemy of the Israeli military.
Yeah.
Can I just say one last thing on this question of intentionality? Because I just think it is sort of like the elephant in the room. And mm-hmm. I think one other thing that's really kind of complicated this or kind of raised more questions for humanitarians is the reporting on the use of AI by the Israeli military in the war. And I think it's not so much that the humanitarians think that AI is being used to target them specifically, but I think it's the reported Israeli thresholds for fatalities being so high with AI, you know, the how many people the Israelis are willing to kill reportedly when they use these AI machines. Pair that with the fact that Gaza is so dense. I think one major concern for humanitarians is that there's no place that is safe for them. They don't normally operate inside battlefields. They operate maybe close to a front line, but somehow outside of it. But in Gaza, that just doesn't seem possible.
Yeah. And as you say, that use of AI and the fact that artificial intelligence seems to have even a higher kill ratio is very alarming and very concerning. You also make the point that the situation is caused in part by poor communications, and that's part of the Israeli defense on the hit on the World Central Kitchen. But can you explain a little more detail what you mean about that communications point?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked about this because I didn't go so in depth in the piece, and I'd really like to explain it. So you can either, if you're an NGO, pass your coordinates through the UN, who then pass them to the parties to the conflict, or so some organizations will choose to pass their coordinates themselves to the parties to the conflict. But the issue is, and this is really a big issue, if there's an emergency on the ground, there's no way for these organizations to reach the Israeli military directly. Because when they're sharing their coordinates with Israel, they're not sharing them with the Israeli military directly. They're sharing them, again, with COGAT. So if there's an emergency on the ground, if there's fighting, if you're stuck in a firefight, you can't call up the Israeli military. There's no hotline. You have to call your organization, who then relays the message to COGAT, who then relays that message to the Israeli military. So it's a game of Chinese whispers. And it's really not great if you're in the middle of a firefight. And I wanted to mention, I thought it was very interesting. I read this looking at the IDF's readout on what happened with the World Central Kitchen. It seems that a little less than an hour before the Israelis fired missiles at that convoy, they tried to contact COGAT because they spotted someone that they thought was armed on one of the trucks in the convoy. But they knew it was a humanitarian convoy and they wanted to figure out what was going on. So they contacted COGAT, and then apparently COGAT tried to contact World Central Kitchen staff on the ground and couldn't get hold of them. And then they also tried to call a World Central Kitchen operations center in Europe and didn't get through. And this was, you know, this was less than an hour before they shot at them. So I think you can see there the communication breakdown both ways. There's no hotline to call the Israeli military, and the Israeli military struggles to get in touch with these organizations on the ground. And I also just wanted to make two other points, which is just that in most conflicts, aid workers will have things like two-way radios and access to mobile networks. So they're able to, you know, call each other, like 3G, 4G, 5G. But that's not true in Gaza. And that's because Israel is concerned that Hamas will seize equipment or use networks to their advantage, right? But this means that these aid groups are essentially really struggling to communicate on the ground. And so that's one thing that's quite unusual about this conflict. The other communication issue I just wanted to mention is that there are real questions about how coordinates, once they're shared, are being communicated up and down the Israeli chain of command. So, you know, we were just talking about the World Central Kitchen attack. It would definitely seem in that case the coordinates didn't get to the right people, or there was just a real problem with communication there. And that's, you know, that's one really big concern for these aid workers on the ground in Gaza. They say, yeah, we share our coordinates, but are the people on the ground getting them? Do they know that aid workers are staying in compounds or are on the move? Do soldiers who are actually on the ground know that? And if they do know that, if they do actually have the coordinates, have they been trained enough to handle them correctly and with respect? That's just a big question.
You're listening to the Arab Digest podcast with me, William Law, and Dania Akkad, Senior Investigative Editor, Middle East Eye. Arab Digest is a truly independent voice on the Middle East and North Africa. No advertising and no sponsors. In the information overload world in which we all find ourselves, Arab Digest keeps it simple. One insightful article a day and the weekly podcast from top experts, analysts, writers, and commentators. Contributors like Tanya. Here at Arab Digest, we have put together a team you will not find anywhere else. Check us out on arabdigest.org. When you go to the website, be sure and look out for the offer of a free 2-month trial to our reader-supported daily newsletter. Tanya, you raised the question about how much information IDF soldiers on the ground have about the humanitarian aid workers. Are they getting the right information? And if they are they using it appropriately? The evidence is accumulating that they are not. These are all things that we need answers to. But there is another question that I wanted to raise with you, and that is concerning aid coming in via land routes. The Israelis say it is the fault of the UN and they are not to blame for the trickle of aid getting into Gaza. How do you assess that claim?
Yeah, so in the last few weeks since the World Central Kitchen attack, it does seem like Israel has been working to enable more trucks to get into Gaza, and it's opened a new crossing in the north. And it's using the Ashdod port to get humanitarian goods in for the first time. So there seems to be more goodwill on the Israeli side to kind of increase this flow. But the problem is that aid workers are saying this is not enough to avoid famine in the north. And that's because, you know, one of the major issues is distributing the aid once it gets into Gaza. And honestly, those are issues, as far as I can see, that are not the fault of the UN or aid organizations, but they're really the result of months of war. You have, you know, roads that are destroyed, which means that aid convoys are taking very predictable routes, which are easy, you know, for people who want to loot to jump and grab stuff. There's ongoing fighting. There are checkpoints where Israeli military can, you know, hold convoys at length. And there are these security issues when these convoys are swarmed and ransacked by extremely hungry people. You also have, you know, the UN is reporting, even since the World Central Kitchen, Israel has been denying access to aid missions. Apparently 15% of the aid missions since the World Central Kitchen up until the 19th of April were denied or impeded in some way by the Israeli authorities. And getting to the north, where people need this food the most, is really still a problem because of these restrictions that the Israeli military is imposing. And also because aid groups are canceling trips there because it's risky. So there's a lot of factors. And it's clear that humanitarians are saying they need more help once those trucks get into Gaza. Jamie McGoldrick, again, the top UN aid official in Gaza, outgoing, he finished his role a couple of weeks ago, but he was saying in his last press conference that he believes that Israel's responsibility to get that aid to civilians doesn't end when the trucks cross into Gaza, but it ends when they actually get to the civilians. And to do that, he said the Israelis need to facilitate more routes in and provide more security. So I don't think this is something that can be blamed on humanitarians or the UN. I think getting aid to those who need it in Gaza right now is a problem for everyone. And it's clearly something that everyone's going to have to work together to make happen.
It's interesting, Danya, and you made this point in your article as well, that in another conflict zone, which is Yemen, the Saudis have done a much better job in handling humanitarian aid. Comparisons can be useful. So what are the Saudis doing that the Israelis have not thus far done?
Well, you know, it's really simple. It's kind of interesting. So I understand that at kind of the height of the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen, that basically there were these face-to-face conversations with the Saudis. So in other words, when humanitarians had issues on the ground, or when they had a convoy on the move, or they wanted to protect a site, they communicated directly with the Saudis in real time through, as I understand it, sort of digitally, you know, so calling them up, or maybe even, I don't know if it was Zoom or what they would have used, but they were able to communicate directly, which is, it, you know, 6 months into this war, that's still apparently not happening. And it's also interesting, apparently back in 2006, during the war between Israel and Hezbollah, there was a senior UN humanitarian who was embedded in the Israeli operations room, in the Israeli military operations room, to literally help deconfliction. So to kind of just to advise and say, hey, we've got people here, we've got people here, don't hit here. That was 2006. That's not happening anymore. There's not a direct line of communication. And I wanted to mention, you know, one of the things that's come about since the World Central Kitchen attack is that the Israeli Defense Minister, Yoav Golan, he announced, you know, less than a week after the attack, that there was this new cell he was establishing, this humanitarian deconfliction cell, to help solve this very problem. And, you know, U.S. Ambassador Jack Lew was given a tour of the cell, and humanitarians welcome this. They say, yes, it would be great to have a face-to-face or to be in the same place and be able to talk. But it's unclear to me whether this cell is actually up and running yet. As of last week, you know, when we put our story out, I asked the Israeli military, you know, do you have a humanitarian in the room in that cell right now? And I didn't get an answer. I think that's definitely something we should keep asking the Israeli military.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, it's interesting, again, looking at the Saudis, because the Saudis took a lot of heat, particularly from the Americans, over the way they were conducting and prosecuting that war in Yemen. You know, you look at the way in which the IDF has prosecuted this war, this time, the targeting of schools, of hospitals, of humanitarian aid workers. The Biden administration has been pressuring Israel on the aid front while continuing to supply the bombs, it has to be said, that are killing civilians among them, aid workers, of course. There's some indication that they may perhaps sanction some of the IDF forces that have been perhaps most egregiously violating people's rights and carrying out atrocities. Do you think that U.S. pressure is working? And also, I have to ask you, because here we are in London, should the U.K. be doing more on that front?
We're seeing more aid apparently getting in now to Gaza after the World Central Kitchen attack and after pressure has been applied clearly by Biden and by Sunak and Cameron. So you could say some of that pressure has been working, but we're now at over 34,000 Palestinians killed in Gaza. And there's a, you know, we keep saying looming famine. We've been saying looming famine for weeks now. I think Samantha Powers was even saying recently that it's already established that there's a famine in some places. So, you know, I think it would be fair for some to say that this is a little too late. But, you know, I also really wanted to go back to something that happened in January to answer this question. It's an incident that's really stuck with me. And actually, it's the reason why I looked into deconfliction in the first place. So back on the 18th of January, there was this compound in Gaza in an area called El Mawasi. And it's a compound that the International Rescue Committee and the Medical Aid for Palestine, where they had some of their staff house and some doctors who were working at a nearby hospital. And on the morning of the 18th of January, it was bombed, an F-16 dropped a 1,000-pound bomb on this compound, which was not near any other compounds, and which, by the way, had been also deconflicted. And what a UN investigation came to find out was that potentially UK-made components and US weapons were used in that attack that hit a UK and an American organization. So I feel like that attack captures the complications of all this in a nutshell. And I, you know, you might have thought that after that attack, there would have been pressure on the US and the UK to stop arms sales to Israel or to put more public pressure on, but that didn't really happen. And then you have the World Central Kitchen attack, where both countries lose nationals in that attack. You have a dual American Canadian, and then you have these three British aid workers, or I think they were security actually, who were killed. And that didn't actually bring about the end of arms sales. Although it did, it made pressure mount for our governments to say something and to show strength publicly, but we didn't stop selling arms. And then, you know, as this is all happening, you have the Iranian consulate attacked, most likely by Israel, and then you have this response from Iran. And this is, you know, no doubt complicated this picture, because now these allies want to sweep in to defend Israel, and they also need to persuade Israel not to widen this war. And maybe we're out of the woods now that Israel has done its response. But, you know, who knows? And I think this complicates things, because it means that the Americans and the Brits are going to have to use the leverage that they have now to cover both this Iran issue and the pressure to get aid in and the pressure to protect humanitarians. So there's a lot going on. And I think this Iran situation will have complicated things. But, you know, as long as Israel oversees one of the largest humanitarian crises on the planet right now, it's going to continue to be under pressure from Western governments, because they are going to be under pressure from their constituents. And if Israel doesn't change its conduct, it's going to continue to face these calls from Western governments. And, you know, to date, clearly the pressure hasn't been enough. If you're a Palestinian on the ground, it just hasn't been enough. But as the war continues, these calls are inevitably going to mount. And I think we'll see what happens. But yeah, to date, clearly the pressure is not enough.
We'll leave it there, Danya. And I thank you for coming on. It's not an easy story. It's not a story with easy answers, but surely answers must be found. And the sooner the better that humanitarian aid gets in to the people of Gaza, we can hope. And I thank you for opening it up for a conversation.
Well, thank you so much for the time to do it. It's really, really important. And I really hope we keep covering this, all journalists, because I think it's an ongoing issue that needs some light shed on it.
My guest today on the Arab Digest podcast was Dania Akkad, senior investigative editor at Middle East Eye. You'll have noticed that we bring you the podcast with no advertising and no sponsors. We are a truly independent source for analysis and commentary on the Middle East and North Africa. If you'd like to support our independent voice, head to our website at arabdigest.org, where you can find out about our reader-supported daily newsletter and how to get a free two-month trial. The newsletter features the very best of MENA analysts, commentators and writers, contributors like Dania. Check us out on arabdigest.org. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter and LinkedIn, and search our library of more than 200 podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, SoundCloud, or Amazon. Our podcast guests provide unique insights, insights you simply will not find anywhere else. Thank you for listening. I'm William Law, editor of the Arab Digest. Essential reading, essential listening from independent sources.